But how did God enjoin that law? And why was the sun? And suddenly the sequence of these thoughts broke off, and Prince Andrew heard, without knowing whether it was a delusion or reality, a soft, whispering voice, incessantly and rhythmically repeating, "Piti, piti, piti," and then "titi," and then again "piti, piti, piti," and "titi" once more. At the same time, he felt that above his face, above the very middle of it, some strange airy structure was being erected out of slender needles or splinters to the sound of this whispered music. He felt that he had to balance carefully, though it was difficult, so that this airy structure should not collapse. But nevertheless it kept collapsing, and again slowly rising to the sound of whispered rhythmic music. It stretches, stretches, spreading out and stretching, said Prince Andrew to himself. While listening to this whispering, and feeling the sensation of this drawing out and the construction of this edifice of needles, he also saw, by glimpses, a red halo round the candle, and heard the rustle of the cockroaches and the buzzing of the fly that flopped against his pillow and his face. Each time the fly touched his face, it gave him a burning sensation. And yet, to his surprise, it did not destroy the structure, though it knocked against the very region of his face where it was rising. But besides this, there was something else of importance. It was something white by the door, the statue of a sphinx, which also oppressed him. But perhaps that's my shirt on the table, he thought. And that's my legs, and that is the door. But why is it always stretching and drawing itself out, and piti piti piti, and titi, and piti piti piti? That's enough, please leave off, Prince Andrew painfully entreated someone. And suddenly thoughts and feelings again swam to the surface of his mind with peculiar clearness and force. Yes, love, he thought again quite clearly. But not love which loves for something, for some quality, for some purpose, or for some reason, but the love which I, while dying, first experienced when I saw my enemy and yet loved him. I experienced that feeling of love which is the very essence of the soul and does not require an object. Now again I feel that bliss. To love one's neighbors, to love one's enemies, to love everything, to love God in all his manifestations. It is possible to love someone dear to you with human love, but an enemy can only be loved by divine love. That is why I experienced such joy when I felt that I loved that man. What has become of him? Is he alive? When loving with human love, one may pass from love to hatred, but divine love cannot change. No, neither death nor anything else can destroy it. It is the very essence of the soul. How many people have I hated in my life? And of them all, I loved and hated none as I did her. And he vividly pictured to himself Natasha, not as he had done in the past, with nothing but her charms which gave him delight, but for the first time picturing to himself her soul. And he understood her feelings, her sufferings, shame, and remorse. He now understood for the first time all the cruelty of his rejection of her, the cruelty of his rupture with her. If only it were possible for me to see her once more, just once, looking into those eyes to say, piti, 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 and titi, and piti, 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 boom, flopped the fly. and his attention was suddenly carried into another world, a world of reality and delirium in which something particular was happening. In that world, some structure was still being erected and did not fall. Something was still stretching out, and the candle with its red halo was still burning, and the same shirt-like sphinx lay near the door. But besides all this, something creaked. There was a whiff of fresh air, and a new white sphinx appeared, standing at the door. And that sphinx had the pale face and shining eyes of the very Natasha of whom he had just been thinking. "Oh, how oppressive this continual delirium is," thought Prince Andrew, trying to drive that face from his imagination. But the face remained before him with the force of reality and drew nearer. Prince Andrew wished to return to that former world of pure thought, but he could not, and delirium drew him back into its domain. The soft, whispering voice continued its rhythmic murmur. Something oppressed him and stretched out, and the strange face was before him. Prince Andrew collected all his strength in an effort to recover his senses. He moved a little, and suddenly there was a ringing in his ears, a dimness in his eyes, and like a man plunged into water, he lost consciousness. When he came to himself, Natasha, that same living Natasha whom of all people he most longed to love with this new, pure, divine love that had been revealed to him, was kneeling before him. He realized that it was the real living Natasha, and he was not surprised, but quietly happy. Natasha, motionless on her knees, she was unable to stir, with frightened eyes riveted on him, was restraining her sobs. Her face was pale and rigid. Only in the lower part of it something quivered. Prince Andrew sighed with relief, smiled, and held out his hand. "You," he said, "how fortunate." With a rapid but careful movement, Natasha drew nearer to him on her knees, and taking his hand carefully, bent her face over it and began kissing it, just touching it lightly with her lips. "Forgive me," she whispered, raising her head and glancing at him. "Forgive me. I love you," said Prince Andrew. "Forgive, forgive what?" he asked. "Forgive me for what I have done," faltered Natasha in a scarcely audible broken whisper, and began kissing his hand more rapidly, just touching it with her lips. "I love you more, better than before," said Prince Andrew, lifting her face with his hand so as to look into her eyes. Those eyes, filled with happy tears, gazed at him timidly, compassionately, and with joyous love. Natasha's thin, pale face with its swollen lips was more than plain. It was dreadful. But Prince Andrew did not see that. He saw her shining eyes, which were beautiful. They heard the sound of voices behind them. Peter, the valet, who was now wide awake, had roused the doctor. Timohin, who had not slept at all because of the pain in his leg, had long been watching all that was going on, carefully covering his bare body with the sheet as he huddled up on his bench. "What's this?" said the doctor, rising from his bed. "Please go away, madam." At that moment, a maid sent by the countess, who had noticed her daughter's absence, knocked at the door. Like a somnambulist aroused from her sleep, Natasha went out of the room, and returning to her hut, fell sobbing on her bed. From that time, during all the rest of the Rostovs' journey, at every halting place and wherever they spent a night, Natasha never left the wounded Bolkonski, and the doctor had to admit that he had not expected from a young girl either such firmness or such skill in nursing a wounded man. Dreadful as the countess imagined it would be should Prince Andrew die in her daughter's arms during the journey, as, judging by what the doctor said, it seemed might easily happen, she could not oppose Natasha. Though with the intimacy now established between the wounded man and Natasha, the thought occurred that, should he recover, their former engagement would be renewed. No one, least of all Natasha and Prince Andrew, spoke of this. The unsettled question of life and death which hung not only over Bolkonsky but over all Russia, shut out all other considerations. Chapter 16. Pierre sets out to meet Napoleon. He saves a child, defends an Armenian girl from a French soldier, and is arrested as an incendiary. On the 3rd of September, Pierre awoke late. His head was aching. The clothes in which he had slept without undressing felt uncomfortable on his body, and his mind had a dim consciousness of something shameful he had done the day before. That something shameful was his yesterday's conversation with Captain Ramballe. It was 11 by the clock, but it seemed peculiarly dark out of doors. Pierre rose, rubbed his eyes, and seeing the pistol with an engraved stock which Gerasim had replaced on the writing table, he remembered where he was and what lay before him that very day. "Am I not too late?" he thought. "No, probably he won't make his entry into Moscow before noon." Pierre did not allow himself to reflect on what lay before him, but hastened to act. After arranging his clothes, he took the pistol and was about to go out. But it then occurred to him for the first time that he certainly could not carry the weapon in his hand through the streets. It was difficult to hide such a big pistol, even under his wide coat. He could not carry it unnoticed in his belt or under his arm. Besides, it had been discharged, and he had not had time to reload it. "No matter. The dagger will do," he said to himself, though when planning his design he had more than once come to the conclusion that the chief mistake made by the student in 1809 had been to try to kill Napoleon with a dagger. But as his chief aim consisted not in carrying out his design, but in proving to himself that he would not abandon his intention and was doing all he could to achieve it, Pierre hastily took the blunt, jagged dagger in a green sheath which he had bought at the Sukhariev market with the pistol and hid it under his waistcoat. Having tied a girdle over his coat and pulled his cap low on his head, Pierre went down the corridor, trying to avoid making a noise or meeting the captain, and passed out into the street. The conflagration at which he had looked with so much indifference the evening before had greatly increased during the night. Moscow was on fire in several places. The buildings in Carriage Row across the river, in the bazaar and the Povarskoy, as well as the barges on the Moskva River and the timber yards by the Dorogomilov Bridge, were all ablaze. Pierre's way led through side streets to the Povarskoy, and from there to the Church of St. Nicholas on the Arbat, where he had long before decided that the deed should be done. The gates of most of the houses were locked and the shutters up. The streets and lanes were deserted. The air was full of smoke and the smell of burning. Now and then he met Russians with anxious and timid faces, and Frenchmen with an air not of the city but of the camp, walking in the middle of the streets. Both the Russians and the French looked at Pierre with surprise. Besides his height and stoutness, and the strange, morose look of suffering in his face and whole figure, the Russians stared at him because they could not make out to what class he could belong. The French followed him with astonishment in their eyes, chiefly because Pierre, unlike all the other Russians, who gazed at the French with fear and curiosity, paid no attention to them. At the gate of one house, three Frenchmen who were explaining something to some Russians who did not understand them stopped Pierre, asking if he did not know French. Pierre shook his head and went on. In another side street, a sentinel standing beside a green caisson shouted at him, but only when the shout was threateningly repeated and he heard the click of the man's musket as he raised it did Pierre understand that he had to pass on the other side of the street. He heard nothing and saw nothing of what went on around him. He carried his resolution within himself in terror and haste, like something dreadful and alien to him, for after the previous night's experience he was afraid of losing it. But he was not destined to bring his mood safely to his destination, and even had he not been hindered by anything on the way, his intention could not now have been carried out, for Napoleon had passed the Arbat more than 4 hours previously on his way from the Dorogomilov suburb to the Kremlin, and was now sitting in a very gloomy frame of mind in a royal study in the Kremlin, giving detailed and exact orders as to measures to be taken immediately to extinguish the fire, to prevent looting, and to reassure the inhabitants. But Pierre did not know this. He was entirely absorbed in what lay before him, and was tortured, as those are who obstinately undertake a task that is impossible for them, not because of its difficulty, but because of its incompatibility with their natures. He was tortured by the fear of weakening at the decisive moment, and so losing his self-esteem. Though he heard and saw nothing around him, he found his way by instinct, and did not go wrong in the side streets that led to the Povarskoy. As Pierre approached that street, the smoke became denser and denser. He even felt the heat of the fire. Occasionally, curly tongues of flame rose from under the roofs of the houses. He met more people in the streets, and they were more excited. But Pierre, though he felt that something unusual was happening around him, did not realize that he was approaching the fire. As he was going along a footpath across a wide open space adjoining the Povarskoy on one side and the gardens of Prince Gruzinski's house on the other, Pierre suddenly heard the desperate weeping of a woman close to him. He stopped as if awakening from a dream and lifted his head. By the side of the path, on the dusty dry grass, all sorts of household goods lay in a heap, feather beds, a samovar, icons, and trunks. On the ground beside the trunk sat a thin woman, no longer young, with long, prominent upper teeth, and wearing a black cloak and cap. This woman, swaying to and fro and muttering something, was choking with sobs. Two girls of about 10 and 12, dressed in dirty short frocks and cloaks, were staring at their mother with a look of stupefaction on their pale, frightened faces. The youngest child, a boy of about 7, who wore an overcoat and an immense cap evidently not his own, was crying in his old nurse's arms. A dirty, barefooted maid was sitting on a trunk, and having undone her pale-colored plait, was pulling it straight and sniffing at her singed hair. The woman's husband, a short, round-shouldered man in the undress uniform of a civilian official, with sausage-shaped whiskers and showing under his square-set cap the hair smoothly brushed forward over his temples, with expressionless face was moving the trunks which were placed one on another, and was dragging some garments from under them. As soon as she saw Pierre, the woman almost threw herself at his feet.
"Dear people, good Christians, save me, help me, dear friends. Help us, somebody," she muttered between her sobs. "My girl, my daughter, my youngest daughter is left behind. She's burnt. Oh, was it for this I nursed you? Oh."
"Don't, Mary Nikolaevna," said her husband to her in a low voice, evidently only to justify himself before the stranger. "Sister must have taken her, or else where can she be?" he added.
"Monster! Villain!"
shouted the woman angrily, suddenly ceasing to weep. "You have no heart. You don't feel for your own child. Another man would have rescued her from the fire, but this is a monster, and neither a man nor a father. You, honored sir, are a noble man," she went on, addressing Pierre rapidly between her sobs.
"The fire broke out alongside and blew our way. The maid called out fire, and we rushed to collect our things. We ran out just as we were. This is what we've brought away. The icons of my dowry bed, all the rest is lost. We seized the children, but not Katie, oh, Lord."
And again she began to sob.
"My child, my dear one, burned, burned."
"But where was she left?" asked Pierre. From the expression of his animated face, the woman saw that this man might help her.
"Oh, dear sir," she cried, seizing him by the legs, "my benefactor, set my heart at ease. Aniska, go, you horrid girl, show him the way," she cried to the maid, angrily opening her mouth and still farther exposing her long teeth.
"Show me the way, show me, I'll do it," gasped Pierre rapidly. The dirty maidservant stepped from behind the trunk, put up her plait, sighed, and went on her short bare feet along the path. Pierre felt as if he had come back to life after a heavy swoon. He held his head higher, his eyes shone with the light of life, and with swift steps he followed the maid, overtook her, and came out on the Povarskoy. The whole street was full of clouds of black smoke. Tongues of flame here and there broke through that cloud. A great number of people crowded in front of the conflagration. In the middle of the street stood a French general saying something to those around him. Pierre, accompanied by the maid, was advancing to the spot where the general stood, but the French soldiers stopped him.
"On ne passe pas!"
"You can't pass," cried a voice.
"This way, uncle," cried the girl. "We'll pass through the side street by the Nikulins."
Pierre turned back, giving a spring now and then to keep up with her. She ran across the street, turned down a side street to the left, and, passing three houses, turned into a yard on the right. It's here, close by, said she, and running across the yard, opened a gate in a wooden fence, and stopping, pointed out to him a small wooden wing of the house which was burning brightly and fiercely. One of its sides had fallen in, another was on fire, and bright flames issued from the openings of the windows and from under the roof. As Pierre passed through the fence gate, he was enveloped by hot air and involuntarily stopped. "Which is it? Which is your house?" he asked.
"Oh," wailed the girl, pointing to the wing. "That's it. That was our lodging. Oh, you burned to death our treasure, Katie, my precious little missy. Oh,"
lamented Aniska, who at the sight of the fire felt that she too must give expression to her feelings. Pierre rushed to the wing, but the heat was so great that he involuntarily passed round in a curve and came upon the large house that was as yet burning only at one end, just below the roof, and around which swarmed a crowd of Frenchmen. At first Pierre did not realize what these men who were dragging something out were about, but seeing before him a Frenchman hitting a peasant with a blunt saber and trying to take from him a fox fur coat, he vaguely understood that looting was going on there, but he had no time to dwell on that idea. The sounds of crackling and the din of falling walls and ceilings, the whistle and hiss of the flames, the excited shouts of the people, and the sight of the swaying smoke, now gathering into thick black clouds and now soaring up with glittering sparks, with here and there dense sheaves of flame, now red and now like golden fish scales creeping along the walls, and the heat and smoke and rapidity of motion, produced on Pierre the usual animating effects of a conflagration. It had a peculiarly strong effect on him, because at the sight of the fire he felt himself suddenly freed from the ideas that had weighed him down. He felt young, bright, adroit, and resolute. He ran round to the other side of the lodge and was about to dash into that part of it which was still standing, when just above his head he heard several voices shouting, and then a cracking sound, and the ring of something heavy falling close beside him. Pierre looked up, and saw at a window of the large house some Frenchmen who had just thrown out the drawer of a chest filled with metal articles. Other French soldiers standing below went up to the drawer. "What does this fellow want?" shouted one of them, referring to Pierre. "There's a child in that house. Haven't you seen a child?" cried Pierre. "What's he talking about? Get along," said several voices, and one of the soldiers, evidently afraid that Pierre might want to take from them some of the plate and bronzes that were in the drawer, moved threateningly toward him. "A child?" shouted a Frenchman from above. "I did hear something squealing in the garden. Perhaps it's his brat that the fellow's looking for. After all, one must be human, you know. Where is it? Where?" said Pierre. "There, there!" shouted the Frenchman at the window, pointing to the garden at the back of the house. "Wait a bit, I'm coming down." And a minute or two later the Frenchman, a black-eyed fellow with a spot on his cheek, in shirt sleeves, really did jump out of a window on the ground floor, and clapping Pierre on the shoulder, ran with him into the garden. "Hurry up, you others," he called out to his comrades. "It's getting hot!" When they reached a gravel path behind the house, the Frenchman pulled Pierre by the arm and pointed to a round, graveled space where a 3-year-old girl in a pink dress was lying under a seat. "There's your child." "Oh, a girl, so much the better," said the Frenchman. "Goodbye, fatty. We must be human. We're all mortal, you know." And the Frenchman with the spot on his cheek ran back to his comrades. Breathless with joy, Pierre ran to the little girl and was going to take her in his arms. But seeing a stranger, the sickly, scrofulous-looking child, unattractively like her mother, began to yell and run away. Pierre, however, seized her and lifted her in his arms. She screamed desperately and angrily and tried with her little hands to pull Pierre's hands away and to bite them with her slobbering mouth. Pierre was seized by a sense of horror and repulsion such as he had experienced when touching some nasty little animal. But he made an effort not to throw the child down and ran with her to the large house. It was now, however, impossible to get back the way he had come. The maid Aniska was no longer there, and Pierre, with a feeling of pity and disgust, pressed the wet, painfully sobbing child to himself as tenderly as he could and ran with her through the garden, seeking another way out. Having run through different yards and side streets, Pierre got back with his little burden to the Gruzinski garden at the corner of the Poverskoy. He did not at first recognize the place from which he had set out to look for the child, so crowded was it now with people and goods that had been dragged out of the houses. Besides Russian families who had taken refuge here from the fire with their belongings, there were several French soldiers in a variety of clothing. Pierre took no notice of them. He hurried to find the family of that civil servant in order to restore the daughter to her mother and go to save someone else. Pierre felt that he had still much to do and to do quickly. Glowing with the heat and from running, he felt at that moment more strongly than ever the sense of youth, animation, and determination that had come on him when he ran to save the child. She had now become quiet, and, clinging with her little hands to Pierre's coat, sat on his arm, gazing about her like some little wild animal. He glanced at her occasionally with a slight smile. He fancied he saw something pathetically innocent in that frightened, sickly little face. He did not find the civil servant or his wife where he had left them. He walked among the crowd with rapid steps, scanning the various faces he met. Involuntarily, he noticed a Georgian or Armenian family consisting of a very handsome old man of Oriental type, wearing a new cloth-covered sheepskin coat and new boots, an old woman of similar type, and a young woman. That very young woman seemed to Pierre the perfection of Oriental beauty, with her sharply outlined, arched black eyebrows and the extraordinarily soft, bright color of her long, beautiful, expressionless face. Amid the scattered property and the crowd on the open space, she in her rich satin cloak with a bright lilac shawl on her head suggested a delicate exotic plant thrown out onto the snow. She was sitting on some bundles a little behind the old woman and looked from under her long lashes with motionless, large, almond-shaped eyes at the ground before her. Evidently she was aware of her beauty and fearful because of it. Her face struck Pierre, and hurrying along by the fence, he turned several times to look at her. When he had reached the fence, still without finding those he sought, he stopped and looked about him. With the child in his arms, his figure was now more conspicuous than before, and a group of Russians, both men and women, gathered about him. "Have you lost anyone, my dear fellow? You're of the gentry yourself, aren't you? Whose child is it?" they asked him. Pierre replied that the child belonged to a woman in a black cloak who had been sitting there with her other children, and he asked whether anyone knew where she had gone. "Why, that must be the Anferovs," said an old deacon, addressing a pockmarked peasant woman. "Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy," he added in his customary bass. "The Anferovs? No," said the woman. "They left in the morning. That must be either Mary Nikolaevna's or the Ivanovs." "He says a woman, and Mary Nikolaevna is a lady," remarked a house serf. "Do you know her? She's thin, with long teeth," said Pierre. "But that's Mary Nikolaevna. They went inside the garden when these wolves swooped down," said the woman, pointing to the French soldiers. "Oh, Lord have mercy," added the deacon. "Go over that way. They're there. It's she. She kept on lamenting and crying," continued the woman. "It's she. Here, this way." But Pierre was not listening to the woman. He had for some seconds been intently watching what was going on a few steps away. He was looking at the Armenian family and at two French soldiers who had gone up to them. One of these, a nimble little man, was wearing a blue coat tied round the waist with a rope. He had a nightcap on his head and his feet were bare. The other, whose appearance particularly struck Pierre, was a long, lank, round-shouldered, fair-haired man, slow in his movements and with an idiotic expression of face. He wore a woman's loose gown of frieze, blue trousers, and large torn Hessian boots. The little barefooted Frenchman in the blue coat went up to the Armenians and, saying something, immediately seized the old man by his legs, and the old man at once began pulling off his boots. The other, in the frieze gown, stopped in front of the beautiful Armenian girl and, with his hands in his pockets, stood staring at her, motionless and silent. "Here, take the child," said Pierre peremptorily and hurriedly to the woman, handing the little girl to her. "Give her back to them. Give her back," he almost shouted, putting the child, who began screaming, on the ground and again looking at the Frenchman and the Armenian family. The old man was already sitting barefoot. The little Frenchman had secured his second boot and was slapping one boot against the other. The old man was saying something in a voice broken by sobs, but Pierre caught but a glimpse of this. His whole attention was directed to the Frenchman in the frieze gown, who meanwhile, swaying slowly from side to side, had drawn nearer to the young woman, and taking his hands from his pockets, had seized her by the neck. The beautiful Armenian still sat motionless and in the same attitude, with her long lashes drooping as if she did not see or feel what the soldier was doing to her. While Pierre was running the few steps that separated him from the Frenchman, the tall marauder in the frieze gown was already tearing from her neck the necklace the young Armenian was wearing, and the young woman, clutching at her neck, screamed piercingly. "Let that woman alone!" exclaimed Pierre hoarsely in a furious voice, seizing the soldier by his round shoulders and throwing him aside. The soldier fell, got up, and ran away. But his comrade, throwing down the boots and drawing his sword, moved threateningly toward Pierre. "Voyons, pas de bêtises!" "Look here, no nonsense," he cried. Pierre was in such a transport of rage that he remembered nothing, and his strength increased tenfold. He rushed at the barefooted Frenchman, and before the latter had time to draw his sword, knocked him off his feet and hammered him with his fists. Shouts of approval were heard from the crowd around, and at the same moment a mounted patrol of French Uhlans appeared from round the corner. The Uhlans came up at a trot to Pierre and the Frenchman and surrounded them. Pierre remembered nothing of what happened after that. He only remembered beating someone and being beaten, and finally feeling that his hands were bound and that a crowd of French soldiers stood around him and were searching him. "Lieutenant, he has a dagger," were the first words Pierre understood. "Ah, weapon," said the officer, and turned to the barefooted soldier who had been arrested with Pierre. "All right, you can tell all about it at the court-martial." Then he turned to Pierre. "Do you speak French?" Pierre looked around him with bloodshot eyes and did not reply. His face probably looked very terrible, for the officer said something in a whisper, and four more Uhlans left the ranks and placed themselves on both sides of Pierre. "Do you speak French?" the officer asked again, keeping at a distance from Pierre. "Call the interpreter." A little man in Russian civilian clothes rode out from the ranks, and by his clothes and manner of speaking, Pierre at once knew him to be a French salesman from one of the Moscow shops. "He does not look like a common man," said the interpreter, after a searching look at Pierre. "Ah, he looks very much like an incendiary," remarked the officer. "And ask him who he is," he added. "Who are you?" asked the interpreter in poor Russian. "You must answer the chief." "I will not tell you who I am. I'm your prisoner. Take me," Pierre suddenly replied in French. "Ah, muttered the officer with a frown. "Well then, march." A crowd had collected round the Uhlans. Nearest to Pierre stood the pockmarked peasant woman with a little girl, and when the patrol started, she moved forward. "Where are they taking you to, you poor dear?" said she. "And the little girl, what am I to do with her if she's not theirs?" said the woman. "What does the woman want?" asked the officer. Pierre was as if intoxicated. His elation increased at the sight of the little girl he had saved. "What does she want?" he murmured. "She's bringing me my daughter, whom I have just saved from the flames," said he. "Goodbye." And without knowing how this aimless lie had escaped him, he went along with resolute and triumphant steps between the French soldiers. The French patrol was one of those sent out through the various streets of Moscow by Duronel's order to put a stop to the pillage, and especially to catch the incendiaries, who, according to the general opinion which had that day originated among the higher French officers, were the cause of the conflagrations. After marching through a number of streets, the patrol arrested five more Russian suspects: a small shopkeeper, two seminary students, a peasant, and a house serf, besides several looters. But of all these various suspected characters, Pierre was considered to be the most suspicious of all. When they had all been brought for the night to a large house on the Zubov rampart that was being used as a guardhouse, Pierre was placed apart under strict guard. Book 12. 1812. Chapter 1. Anna Pavlovna's soiree. Talk of Hélène's illness. The bishop's letter. Victory at Borodino reported. Death of Hélène. News of abandonment of Moscow. Michaud's report. In Petersburg at that time, A complicated struggle was being carried on with greater heat than ever in the highest circles between the parties of Rumyantsev, the French, Marya Fyodorovna, the Tsarevich, and others, drowned as usual by the buzzing of the court drones. But the calm, luxurious life of Petersburg, concerned only about phantoms and reflections of real life, went on in its old way, and made it hard, except by a great effort, to realize the danger and the difficult position of the Russian people. There were the same receptions and balls, the same French theater, the same court interests and service interests and intrigues as usual. Only in the very highest circles were attempts made to keep in mind the difficulties of the actual position. Stories were whispered of how differently the two empresses behaved in these difficult circumstances. The Empress Maria, the Dowager Empress, concerned for the welfare of the charitable and educational institutions under her patronage, had given directions that they should all be removed to Kazan, and the things belonging to these institutions had already been packed up. The Empress Elizabeth, however, when asked what instructions she would be pleased to give, with her characteristic Russian patriotism, had replied that she could give no directions about state institutions, for that was the affair of the sovereign, but as far as she personally was concerned, she would be the last to quit Petersburg. At Anna Pavlovna's, on the 26th of August, the very day of the Battle of Borodino, there was a soiree, the chief feature of which was to be the reading of a letter from His Lordship the Bishop when sending the Emperor an icon of the Venerable Sergius. It was regarded as a model of ecclesiastical, patriotic eloquence. Prince Vasily himself, famed for his elocution, was to read it. He used to read at the Empress's. The art of his reading was supposed to lie in rolling out the words, quite independently of their meaning, in a loud and sing-song voice, alternating between a despairing wail and a tender murmur, so that the wail fell quite at random on one word and the murmur on another. This reading, as was always the case at Anna Pavlovna's soirees, had a political significance. That evening she expected several important personages who had to be made ashamed of their visits to the French theater and aroused to a patriotic temper. A good many people had already arrived, but Anna Pavlovna, not yet seeing all those whom she wanted in her drawing-room, did not let the reading begin, but wound up the springs of her general conversation. The news of the day in Petersburg was the illness of Countess Bezukhova. She had fallen ill unexpectedly a few days previously, had missed several gatherings of which she was usually the ornament, and was said to be receiving no one, and, instead of the celebrated Petersburg doctors who usually attended her, had entrusted herself to some Italian doctor who was treating her in some new and unusual way. They all knew very well that the enchanting countess's illness arose from an inconvenience resulting from marrying two husbands at the same time, and that the Italian's cure consisted in removing such inconvenience. But in Anna Pavlovna's presence, no one dared to think of this or even appear to know it. "They say the poor countess is very ill. The doctor says it's angina pectoris." "Angina? Oh, that's a terrible illness." "They say that the rivals are reconciled thanks to the angina." And the word angina was repeated with great satisfaction. "Oh, the old count is pathetic, they say. He cried like a child when the doctor told him the case was dangerous. Oh, it would be a terrible loss. She's an enchanting woman." "You're speaking of the poor countess?" said Anna Pavlovna, coming up just then. "I sent to ask for news and hear that she's a little better. Oh, she's certainly the most charming woman in the world," she went on with a smile at her own enthusiasm. "We belong to different camps, but that does not prevent my esteeming her as she deserves. She's very unfortunate," added Anna Pavlovna. Supposing that by these words Anna Pavlovna was somewhat lifting the veil from the secret of the countess's malady, an unwary young man ventured to express surprise that well-known doctors had not been called in, and that the countess was being attended by a charlatan who might employ dangerous remedies. "Your information may be better than mine," Anna Pavlovna suddenly and venomously retorted on the inexperienced young man, "but I know on good authority that this doctor is a very learned and able man. He is private physician to the Queen of Spain." And having thus demolished the young man, Anna Pavlovna turned to another group where Bilibin was talking about the Austrians. Having wrinkled up his face, he was evidently preparing to smooth it out again and utter one of his mots. I think it is delightful, he said, referring to a diplomatic note that had been sent to Vienna with some Austrian banners captured from the French by Wittgenstein, the hero of Petropol, as he was then called in Petersburg. What? What's that? Asked Anna Pavlovna, securing silence for the mot which she had heard before. And Bilibin repeated the actual words of the diplomatic dispatch which he had himself composed. The Emperor returns these Austrian banners, said Bilibin, friendly banners gone astray and found on a wrong path. And his brow became smooth again. Charming, charming, observed Prince Vasily. The path to Warsaw, perhaps, Prince Hippolyte remarked loudly and unexpectedly. Everybody looked at him, not understanding what he meant. Prince Hippolyte himself glanced around with amused surprise. He knew no more than the others what his words meant. During his diplomatic career, he had more than once noticed that such utterances were received as very witty, and at every opportunity he uttered in that way the first words that entered his head. It may turn out very well, he thought, but if not, they'll know how to arrange matters. And really, during the awkward silence that ensued, that insufficiently patriotic person entered, whom Anna Pavlovna had been waiting for and wished to convert, and she, smiling and shaking a finger at Hippolyte, invited Prince Vasily to the table, and bringing him two candles and the manuscript, begged him to begin. Everyone became silent. Most gracious sovereign and emperor, Prince Vasily sternly declaimed, looking round at his audience as if to inquire whether anyone had anything to say to the contrary. But no one said anything. Moscow, our ancient capital, the new Jerusalem, receives her Christ, he placed a sudden emphasis on the word her, as a mother receives her zealous sons into her arms, and through the gathering mists, foreseeing the brilliant glory of thy rule, sings in exultation, Hosanna, blessed is he that cometh. Prince Vasily pronounced these last words in a tearful voice. Bilibin attentively examined his nails, and many of those present appeared intimidated, as if asking in what they were to blame. Anna Pavlovna whispered the next words in advance, like an old woman muttering the prayer at communion. Let the bold and insolent Goliath, she whispered. Prince Vasily continued. Let the bold and insolent Goliath from the borders of France encompass the realms of Russia with death-bearing terrors. Humble faith, the sling of the Russian David, shall suddenly smite his head in his bloodthirsty pride. This icon of the venerable Sergius, the servant of God and zealous champion of old of our country's weal, is offered to your imperial majesty. I grieve that my waning strength prevents my rejoicing in the sight of your most gracious presence. I raise fervent prayers to heaven that the Almighty may exalt the race of the just and mercifully fulfill the desires of your majesty. What force, what a style, was uttered in approval both of reader and of author. Animated by that address, Anna Pavlovna's guests talked for a long time of the state of the fatherland and offered various conjectures as to the result of the battle to be fought in a few days. You will see, said Anna Pavlovna, that tomorrow on the emperor's birthday we shall receive news. I have a favorable presentiment. Anna Pavlovna's presentiment was in fact fulfilled. Next day, during the service at the palace church in honor of the emperor's birthday, Prince Volkonsky was called out of the church and received a dispatch from Prince Kutuzov. It was Kutuzov's report written from Tatarinova on the day of the battle. Kutuzov wrote that the Russians had not retreated a step, that the French losses were much heavier than ours, and that he was writing in haste from the field of battle before collecting full information. It followed that there must have been a victory, and at once, without leaving the church, thanks were rendered to the Creator for his help and for the victory. Anna Pavlovna's presentiment was justified, and all that morning a joyously festive mood reigned in the city. Everyone believed the victory to have been complete, and some even spoke of Napoleon's having been captured, of his deposition, and of the choice of a new ruler for France. It is very difficult for events to be reflected in their real strength and completeness amid the conditions of court life and far from the scene of action. General events involuntarily group themselves around some particular incident. So now, the courtier's pleasure was based as much on the fact that the news had arrived on the emperor's birthday as on the fact of the victory itself. It was like a successfully arranged surprise. Mention was made in Kutuzov's report of the Russian losses, among which figured the names of Tuchkov, Bagration, and Kutaisov. In the Petersburg world, this sad side of the affair again involuntarily centered round a single incident, Kutaisov's death. Everybody knew him, the emperor liked him, and he was young and interesting. That day, everyone met with the words, "What a wonderful coincidence, just during the service. But what a loss Kutaisov is, how sorry I am." "What did I tell you about Kutuzov?" Prince Vasily now said with a prophet's pride. "I always said he was the only man capable of defeating Napoleon." But next day no news arrived from the army, and the public mood grew anxious. The courtiers suffered because of the suffering the suspense occasioned the emperor. "Fancy the emperor's position," said they. And instead of extolling Kutuzov as they had done the day before, they condemned him as the cause of the emperor's anxiety. That day Prince Vasily no longer boasted of his protégé Kutuzov, but remained silent when the commander-in-chief was mentioned. Moreover, toward evening, as if everything conspired to make Petersburg society anxious and uneasy, a terrible piece of news was added. Countess Hélène Bezúkhova had suddenly died of that terrible malady it had been so agreeable to mention. Officially, at large gatherings, everyone said that Countess Bezúkhova had died of a terrible attack of angina pectoris. But in intimate circles, details were mentioned of how the private physician of the Queen of Spain had prescribed small doses of a certain drug to produce a certain effect. But Hélène, tortured by the fact that the old count suspected her, and that her husband, to whom she had written, that wretched, profligate Pierre, had not replied, had suddenly taken a very large dose of the drug and had died in agony before assistance could be rendered her. It was said that Prince Vasily and the old count had turned upon the Italian, but the latter had produced such letters from the unfortunate deceased that they had immediately let the matter drop. Talk in general centered round three melancholy facts: the emperor's lack of news, the loss of Kutaisov, and the death of Hélène. On the third day after Kutuzov's report, a country gentleman arrived from Moscow, and news of the surrender of Moscow to the French spread through the whole town. This was terrible. What a position for the emperor to be in. Kutuzov was a traitor, and Prince Vasily, during the visits of condolence paid to him on the occasion of his daughter's death, said of Kutuzov, whom he had formerly praised — it was excusable for him in his grief to forget what he had said — that it was impossible to expect anything else from a blind and depraved old man. I only wonder that the fate of Russia could have been entrusted to such a man. As long as this news remained unofficial, it was possible to doubt it. But the next day the following communication was received from Count Rostopchin. "Prince Kutuzov's adjutant has brought me a letter in which he demands police officers to guide the army to the Ryazan road. He writes that he is regretfully abandoning Moscow. Sire, Kutuzov's action decides the fate of the capital and of your empire. Russia will shudder to learn of the abandonment of the city in which her greatness is centered and in which lie the ashes of your ancestors. I shall follow the army. I have had everything removed, and it only remains for me to weep over the fate of my fatherland." On receiving this dispatch, the emperor sent Prince Volkonsky to Kutuzov with the following rescript: "Prince Michael Ilarionovich, since the 29th of August, I have received no communication from you. Yet on the 1st of September, I received from the commander-in-chief of Moscow, via Yaroslavl, the sad news that you, with the army, have decided to abandon Moscow. You can yourself imagine the effect this news has had on me, and your silence increases my astonishment. I am sending this by Adjutant General Prince Volkonsky to hear from you the situation of the army and the reasons that have induced you to take this melancholy decision." 9 days after the abandonment of Moscow, a messenger from Kutuzov reached Petersburg with the official announcement of that event. His messenger was Michaud, a Frenchman who did not know Russian, but who was, quoique étranger, russe de cœur et d'âme, though a foreigner, Russian in heart and soul, as he said of himself. The Emperor at once received this messenger in his study at the palace on Stone Island. Michaud, who had never seen Moscow before the campaign and who did not know Russian, yet felt deeply moved, as he wrote, when he appeared before Notre très gracieux souverain, our most gracious sovereign, with the news of the burning of Moscow, dont les flammes éclairaient sa route, whose flames illumined his route. Though the source of Monsieur Michaud's chagrin must have been different from that which caused Russians to grieve, he had such a sad face when shown into the Emperor's study that the latter at once asked, "Have you brought me sad news, Colonel?" "Very sad, sire," replied Michaud, lowering his eyes with a sigh. "The abandonment of Moscow." "Have they surrendered my ancient capital without a battle?" asked the Emperor quickly, his face suddenly flushing. Michaud respectfully delivered the message Kutuzov had entrusted to him, which was that it had been impossible to fight before Moscow, and that as the only remaining choice was between losing the army as well as Moscow, or losing Moscow alone, the field marshal had to choose the latter. The Emperor listened in silence, not looking at Michaud. "Has the enemy entered the city?" he asked. "Yes, sire, and Moscow is now in ashes. I left it all in flames," replied Michaud in a decided tone, but glancing at the Emperor, he was frightened by what he had done. The Emperor began to breathe heavily and rapidly. His lower lip trembled, and tears instantly appeared in his fine blue eyes. But this lasted only a moment. He suddenly frowned, as if blaming himself for his weakness, and raising his head, addressed Michaud in a firm voice. "I see, Colonel, from all that is happening, that Providence requires great sacrifices of us. I am ready to submit myself in all things to his will. But tell me, Michaud, how did you leave the army when it saw my ancient capital abandoned without a battle? Did you not notice discouragement?" Seeing that his most gracious ruler was calm once more, Michaud also grew calm, but was not immediately ready to reply to the Emperor's direct and relevant question, which required a direct answer. "Sire, will you allow me to speak frankly, as befits a loyal soldier?" he asked to gain time. "Colonel, I always require it," replied the Emperor. "Conceal nothing from me. I wish to know absolutely how things are." "Sire," said Michaud, with a subtle, scarcely perceptible smile on his lips, having now prepared a well-phrased reply, "Sire, I left the whole army, from its chiefs to the lowest soldier, without exception, in desperate and agonized terror." "How's that?" the Emperor interrupted him, frowning sternly. "Would misfortune make my Russians lose heart? Never." Michaud had only waited for this to bring out the phrase he had prepared. "Sire," he said with respectful playfulness, "they are only afraid lest your majesty, in the goodness of your heart, should allow yourself to be persuaded to make peace." "They are burning for the combat," declared this representative of the Russian nation, "and to prove to your majesty by the sacrifice of their lives how devoted they are..." "Ah," said the Emperor, reassured, and with a kindly gleam in his eyes, he patted Michaud on the shoulder. "You set me at ease, Colonel." He bent his head and was silent for some time. "Well, then, go back to the army," he said, drawing himself up to his full height and addressing Michaud with a gracious and majestic gesture, "and tell our brave men and all my good subjects wherever you go that when I have not a soldier left, I shall put myself at the head of my beloved nobility and my good peasants, and so use the last resources of my empire. It still offers me more than my enemies suppose," said the Emperor, growing more and more animated. "But should it ever be ordained by divine providence," he continued, raising to heaven his fine eyes shining with emotion, "that my dynasty should cease to reign on the throne of my ancestors, then, after exhausting all the means at my command, I shall let my beard grow to here," he pointed halfway down his chest, "and go and eat potatoes with the meanest of my peasants, rather than sign the disgrace of my country and of my beloved people, whose sacrifices I know how to appreciate." Having uttered these words in an agitated voice, the Emperor suddenly turned away as if to hide from Michaud the tears that rose to his eyes, and went to the further end of his study. Having stood there a few moments, he strode back to Michaud and pressed his arm below the elbow with a vigorous movement. The Emperor's mild and handsome face was flushed, and his eyes gleamed with resolution and anger. Colonel Michaud, do not forget what I say to you here. Perhaps we may recall it with pleasure some day. Napoleon or I, said the Emperor, touching his breast. We can no longer both reign together. I have learned to know him, and he will not deceive me any more. And the Emperor paused with a frown. When he heard these words, and saw the expression of firm resolution in the Emperor's eyes, Michaud, quoique étranger, russe de cœur et d'âme, at that solemn moment felt himself enraptured by all that he had heard, as he used afterwards to say, and gave expression to his own feelings and those of the Russian people, whose representative he considered himself to be, in the following words. Sire, said he, your majesty is at this moment signing the glory of the nation and the salvation of Europe. With an inclination of the head, the emperor dismissed him. Chapter 2. Nicholas sent to Voronezh. An evening at the governor's. Nicholas and Prince Mary. A letter from Sonya. It is natural for us, who were not living in those days, to imagine that when half Russia had been conquered and the inhabitants were fleeing to distant provinces, and one levy after another was being raised for the defense of the fatherland, all Russians, from the greatest to the least, were solely engaged in sacrificing themselves, saving their fatherland, or weeping over its downfall. The tales and descriptions of that time, without exception, speak only of the self-sacrifice, patriotic devotion, despair, grief, and the heroism of the Russians. But it was not really so. It appears so to us because we see only the general historic interest of that time and do not see all the personal human interests that people had. Yet, in reality, those personal interests of the moment so much transcend the general interests that they always prevent the public interest from being felt or even noticed. Most of the people at that time paid no attention to the general progress of events, but were guided only by their private interests. And they were the very people whose activities at that period were most useful. Those who tried to understand the general course of events and to take part in it by self-sacrifice and heroism were the most useless members of society. They saw everything upside down, and all they did for the common good turned out to be useless and foolish. Like Pierre's and Mamonov's regiments, which looted Russian villages, and the lint the young ladies prepared and that would never reach the wounded, and so on. Even those fond of intellectual talk and of expressing their feelings who discussed Russia's position at the time involuntarily introduced into their conversation either a shade of pretense and falsehood or useless condemnation and anger directed against people accused of actions no one could possibly be guilty of. In historic events, the rule forbidding us to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge is specially applicable. Only unconscious action bears fruit, and he who plays a part in an historic event never understands its significance. If he tries to realize it, his efforts are fruitless. The more closely a man was engaged in the events then taking place in Russia, the less did he realize their significance. In Petersburg and in the provinces at a distance from Moscow, ladies and gentlemen in militia uniforms wept for Russia and its ancient capital and talked of self-sacrifice and so on. But in the army, which retired beyond Moscow, there was little talk or thought of Moscow. And when they caught sight of its burned ruins, no one swore to be avenged on the French. But they thought about their next pay, their next quarters, of Matryoshka the Vivandière, and like matters. As the war had caught him in the service, Nicholas Rostov took a close and prolonged part in the defense of his country, but did so casually, without any aim at self-sacrifice, and he therefore looked at what was going on in Russia without despair and without dismally racking his brains over it. Had he been asked what he thought of the state of Russia, he would have said that it was not his business to think about it, that Kutuzov and others were there for that purpose, but that he had heard that the regiments were to be made up to their full strength, that fighting would probably go on for a long time yet, and that things being so, it was quite likely he might be in command of a regiment in a couple of years' time. As he looked at the matter in this way, he learned that he was being sent to Voronezh to buy remounts for his division, not only without regret at being prevented from taking part in the coming battle, but with the greatest pleasure, which he did not conceal, and which his comrades fully understood. A few days before the Battle of Borodino, Nicholas received the necessary money and warrants, and having sent some hussars on in advance, he set out with post-horses for Voronezh. Only a man who has experienced it, that is, has passed some months continuously in an atmosphere of campaigning and war, can understand the delight Nicholas felt when he escaped from the region covered by the army's foraging operations, provision trains, and hospitals. When, free from soldiers, wagons, and the filthy traces of a camp, he saw villages with peasants and peasant women, gentlemen's country houses, fields where cattle were grazing, post houses with station masters asleep in them, he rejoiced as though seeing all this for the first time. What for a long while specially surprised and delighted him were the women, young and healthy, without a dozen officers making up to each of them. Women, too, who were pleased and flattered that a passing officer should joke with them. In the highest spirits, Nicholas arrived at night at a hotel in Voronezh, ordered things he had long been deprived of in camp, and next day, very clean-shaven and in a full-dress uniform he had not worn for a long time, went to present himself to the authorities. The commander of the militia was a civilian general, an old man who was evidently pleased with his military designation and rank. He received Nicholas brusquely, imagining this to be characteristically military, and questioned him with an important air, as if considering the general progress of affairs and approving and disapproving with full right to do so. Nicholas was in such good spirits that this merely amused him. From the commander of the militia, he drove to the governor. The governor was a brisk little man, very simple and affable. He indicated the stud farms at which Nicholas might procure horses, recommended to him a horse dealer in the town and a landowner 14 miles out of town who had the best horses, and promised to assist him in every way. "You're County Yaroslav's son? My wife was a great friend of your mother's. We're at home on Thursdays. Today is Thursday, so please come and see us quite informally," said the governor, taking leave of him. Immediately on leaving the governor's, Nicholas hired post-horses, and taking his squadron quartermaster with him, drove at a gallop to the landowner 14 miles away who had the stud. Everything seemed to him pleasant and easy during that first part of his stay in Voronezh, and as usually happens when a man is in a pleasant state of mind, everything went well and easily. The landowner to whom Nicholas went was a bachelor, an old cavalryman, a horse fancier, a sportsman, the possessor of some century-old brandy and some old Hungarian wine, who had a snuggery where he smoked, and who owned some splendid horses. In very few words, Nicholas bought 17 picked stallions for 6,000 rubles, to serve, as he said, as samples of his remounts. After dining and taking rather too much of the Hungarian wine, Nicholas, having exchanged kisses with the landowner with whom he was already on the friendliest terms, galloped back over abominable roads in the brightest frame of mind, continually urging on the driver so as to be in time for the governor's party. When he had changed, poured water over his head, and scented himself, Nicholas arrived at the governor's rather late, but with the phrase "better late than never" on his lips. It was not a ball, nor had dancing been announced, but everyone knew that Catherine Petrovna would play valses and the écossaise on the clavichord, and that there would be dancing, and so everyone had come as to a ball. Provincial life in 1812 went on very much as usual, but with this difference, that it was livelier in the towns in consequence of the arrival of many wealthy families from Moscow, and, as in everything that went on in Russia at that time, a special recklessness was noticeable, an in-for-a-penny, in-for-a-pound, who-cares spirit, and the inevitable small talk, instead of turning on the weather and mutual acquaintances, now turned on Moscow, the army, and Napoleon. The society gathered together at the governor's was the best in Voronezh. There were a great many ladies and some of Nicholas's Moscow acquaintances, but there were no men who could at all vie with the cavalier of St. George, the hussar remount officer, the good-natured and well-bred Count Rostov. Among the men was an Italian prisoner, an officer of the French army, and Nicholas felt that the presence of that prisoner enhanced his own importance as a Russian hero. The Italian was, as it were, a war trophy. Nicholas felt this. It seemed to him that everyone regarded the Italian in the same light, and he treated him cordially, though with dignity and restraint. As soon as Nicholas entered in his hussar uniform, diffusing around him a fragrance of perfume and wine, and had uttered the words, "Better late than never," and heard them repeated several times by others, people clustered around him, all eyes turned on him, and he felt at once that he had entered into his proper position in the province, that of a universal favorite, a very pleasant position, and intoxicatingly so after his long privations. At posting stations, at inns, and in the landowner's snuggery, maidservants had been flattered by his notice, and here too at the governor's party there were, as it seemed to Nicholas, an inexhaustible number of pretty young women, married and unmarried, impatiently awaiting his notice. The women and girls flirted with him, and from the very first day the old people concerned themselves to get this fine young daredevil of an hussar married and settled down. Among these was the governor's wife herself, who welcomed Rostov as a near relative and called him Nicholas. Catherine Petrovna did actually play valses and the écossaise, and dancing began, in which Nicholas still further captivated the provincial society by his agility. His particularly free manner of dancing even surprised them all. Nicholas was himself rather surprised at the way he danced that evening. He had never danced like that in Moscow, and would even have considered such a very free and easy manner improper and in bad form. But here he felt it incumbent on him to astonish them all by something unusual, something they would have to accept as the regular thing in the capital, though new to them in the provinces. All the evening, Nicholas paid attention to a blue-eyed, plump, and pleasing little blonde, the wife of one of the provincial officials. With the naive conviction of young men in a merry mood that other men's wives were created for them, Rostov did not leave the lady's side and treated her husband in a friendly and conspiratorial style, as if, without speaking of it, they knew how capitally Nicholas and the lady would get on together. The husband, however, did not seem to share that conviction, and tried to behave morosely with Rostov. But the latter's good-natured naivete was so boundless that sometimes even he involuntarily yielded to Nicholas's good humor. Toward the end of the evening, however, as the wife's face grew more flushed and animated, the husband's became more and more melancholy and solemn, as though there were but a given amount of animation between them, and as the wife's share increased, the husband's diminished. Nicholas sat leaning slightly forward in an armchair, bending closely over the blonde lady, and paying her mythological compliments with a smile that never left his face. Jauntily shifting the position of his legs in their tight riding breeches, diffusing an odor of perfume, and admiring his partner, himself, and the fine outlines of his legs in their well-fitting Hessian boots, Nicholas told the blonde lady that he wished to run away with a certain lady here in Voronezh. "Which lady?" "A charming lady, a divine one. Her eyes," Nicholas looked at his partner, "are blue, her mouth coral and ivory, her figure," he glanced at her shoulders, "like Diana's." The husband came up and sullenly asked his wife what she was talking about. "Ah, Nikita Ivanich," cried Nicholas, rising politely. And as if wishing Nikita Ivanich to share his joke, he began to tell him of his intention to elope with a blonde lady. The husband smiled gloomily, the wife gaily. The governor's good-natured wife came up with a look of disapproval. "Anna Ignatyevna wants to see you, Nicholas," said she, pronouncing the name so that Nicholas at once understood that Anna Ignatyevna was a very important person. "Come, Nicholas. Do you know you let me call you so?" "Oh, yes, aunt. Who is she?" "Anna Ignatyevna Malvintseva. She has heard from her niece how you rescued her." "Can you guess?" "Well, I rescued such a lot of them," said Nicholas. "Her niece, Princess Bolkonskaya. She's here in Voronezh with her aunt." "Oh, how you blush! Why, not a bit. No, please don't, aunt." "Very well, very well. Oh, what a fellow you are." The governor's wife led him up to a tall and very stout old lady with a blue headdress who had just finished her game of cards with the most important personages of the town. This was Malvintseva, Princess Mary's aunt on her mother's side, a rich, childless widow who always lived in Voronezh. When Rostov approached her, she was standing, settling up for the game. She looked at him, and screwing up her eyes sternly, continued to upbraid the general who had won from her. "Very pleased, mon cher," she then said, holding out her hand to Nicholas. "Pray come and see me." After a few words about Princess Mary and her late father, whom Malvintseva had evidently not liked, and having asked what Nicholas knew of Prince Andrew, who also was evidently no favorite of hers, the important old lady dismissed Nicholas after repeating her invitation to come to see her. Nicholas promised to come, and blushed again as he bowed. At the mention of Princess Mary, he experienced a feeling of shyness and even of fear, which he himself did not understand. When he had parted from Anna Ignatyevna Malvintseva, Nicholas wished to return to the dancing, but the governor's little wife placed her plump hand on his sleeve, and saying that she wanted to have a talk with him, led him to a sitting room, from which those who were there immediately withdrew so as not to be in her way. "Do you know, dear boy," began the governor's wife with a serious expression on her kind little face, "that really would be the match for you. Would you like me to arrange it?"
"Whom do you mean, aunt?" asked Nicholas.
"I will make a match for you with the princess. Catherine Petrovna speaks of Lily, but I say no, the princess. Do you want me to do it? I'm sure your mother will be grateful to me. What a charming girl she is, really, and she's not at all so plain, either."
"Not at all," replied Nicholas, as if offended at the idea.
"As befits a soldier, aunt, I don't force myself on anyone or refuse anything," he said, before he had time to consider what he was saying.
"Well, then, remember, this is not a joke."
"Of course not."
"Yes, yes," the governor's wife said, as if talking to herself.
"But, my dear boy, among other things, you're too attentive to the other, the blonde. One is sorry for the husband, really."
"Oh, no, we're good friends with him," said Nicholas in the simplicity of his heart. It did not enter his head that a pastime so pleasant to himself might not be pleasant to someone else.
"But what nonsense I've been saying to the governor's wife," thought Nicholas suddenly at supper. "She will really begin to arrange a match."
"And Sonya?"